Okay, good morning, everyone. Chag Sameach.
Good morning.
I thought that this morning we'd talk about what is perhaps one of the more controversial elements of today's celebration, and that is the idea of Mishichut, or Messianism, as it relates to Zionism, contemporary Zionism. And I thought that instead of taking a look at the theological debate that has come to be, to arise over the past probably about 100 years, which is how many people frame the question of messianism in today's contemporary religious Zionist movement, I wanted to look at it from a historical perspective. Where did this come from historically, and can we understand some of the historical events and trends that ultimately helped shape where we are today? And hopefully, by doing so, we'll gain, I think, a broader perspective on the issues and perhaps even a deeper appreciation for where the different perspectives are coming from. I thought I would structure things as follows. I thought we would start here and now, in the present, and kind of work our way back almost 200 years, and then work our way back forward again. So we'll understand the contemporary situation. We'll move back into history to start, try to understand where it came from. We're actually going to move one step even further back, right, from there to try and understand the roots of where that came from, and then we'll move ourselves forwards again and hopefully arrive back where we started, but with a different perspective on the issue. So here we go. I've tried to use only English sources for this, so that everybody is comfortable following along. You'll see that many of the sources were taken, many of the Hebrew sources I've found English translations for, and I even included at the end some of the works where you can find these if you want to read more about them. These are collections of primarily primary source collections that have a lot of this material in it. So if we're going to start in the present, so the place to start in the present, I think, is on page one, and that is with what is perhaps one of the most evocative of the tefillot, of the prayers that we have in our liturgy. It's something which evokes passion on all sides of the equation. It is our tefillah l'shalom ha-medina, the prayer for the welfare of the state of Israel. We said it this morning during our tefillot downstairs. And it's here where we probably get our first introduction, or our most common introduction, to the world, to the notion that somehow Zionism and Messianism are related. Because after all, the tefillah begins, Avinu shebashamayim, tzuri Yisrael v'goalo, barech et medinat Yisrael, so our Father in heaven, protector and redeemer of Israel, bless the state of Israel, the first flowering of our redemption. So the notion that the state of Israel, the modern state of Israel, is connected to the messianic concept, to the concept of a redemption for the Jewish people and a redemption for the world, is one which is clearly stated in this prayer. Now, the tefillah itself was composed by Rav Yitzchak Halevi Herzog, probably a personality, a Torah personality that we in the American Jewish community don't spend nearly enough time understanding and appreciating. The British members of our audience here know that that Rav Yitzchak Halevi Herzog actually grew up in England. He was educated in the Sorbonne, and he actually has a PhD in marine biology from the University of London. He then served as the chief rabbi of Ireland, I believe, for many years before making Aliyah. I think in 1936, he took over for Rav Kook as the chief rabbi of Israel pre-state, right? And was the chief rabbi, the Ashkenazic chief rabbi, as when the state of Israel was declared. And it was in 1948, after the declaration of the state of Israel, he felt the need to create some sort of tefillah, some sort of prayer that thanked God, right, for the creation of the state of Israel. There had been debate for a little while as to whether he wrote it or whether Shai Agnon, who is the great Israeli noble Nobel laureate penned it. It seems quite clear now that it was, in fact, Rabbi Herzog who did it, and then he gave it to Shai Agnon, who made a few edits to it, and that's how it got its final form. But he wrote it in 1948. But today, this tefillah is a staple of modern Orthodox shuls. In fact, it's often for people, right, the indicator as to whether a synagogue identifies itself as modern Orthodox or not is the question of whether they say this particular prayer.
Isn't he the father of Chaim Herzog?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's quite a family. okay, so what we know, though, is that despite the fact that this tefillah is actually quite widespread in the modern Orthodox community, it is, when we look at the broader Orthodox community, it does not enjoy that type of popularity across the spectrum of Orthodox communities, and that's because there's been quite a bit of debate as to whether one can, in fact, or one should, in fact, look at the state of Israel, not as a good thing or as a bad thing, but whether one should look at the state of Israel or ascribe to the state of Israel some piece of the redemptive process. And so let's begin by looking at these voices that here, these passages come from the late 20th century, but these are the voices that are still very much ringing in our community today. So we'll start at the top of page 2. Rabbi Shlomo Aviner is the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivat Ateret Kohanim in the Old City of Jerusalem. He's also the rabbi, I believe, of the town of Beit El, and widely regarded as one of the leading voices that has been for decades of the Dati Leumi, the religious Zionist community in Israel. So Rav Aviner writes as follows: if someone whispers in your ear that he has, quote, not seen the Messiah lately, either in the fields of the Golan or in the expanses of the Sinai, that is, territories taken by Israel, or taken back by Israel, right, in the Six-Day War, he may be an honest man. But if he goes a step further and says, since I have not seen it, it does not exist, his words are falsehood and seduction. Say to him, you may not have seen it, but others have. We declare the absolute certainty of our imminent redemption. All the troubles, delays, and complications we have endured are merely momentary and cannot obscure this mighty overall trend, this Mashiach, whose power has been concealed since ancient times in the treasure house of history, and who is now being revealed in actuality. A clear statement that what is happening in this modern state of Israel is nothing short of a redemptive process. It is the beginnings of the promise that was made to us thousands of years ago that God would take us back, these things would happen, and now anybody, according to Rav Aviner, who can see, right, can see what's happening and look at it objectively, knows that this, in fact, right, is what's taking place and taking shape in the state of Israel today. This notion that the modern state of Israel reflects a piece of the redemptive process is something that has actually united other pieces of the Orthodox community in opposition to it. Right? Other elements of the Jewish community, the Orthodox community, that do not see eye to eye on many other things actually come together in their opposition to this particular idea. So I've given you here two different sources from two very different people representing two very different parts of the community, but who are both quite vociferous in their objection to this idea. So the first is Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson, that is the late Lubavitcher Rebbe. Now, probably far more associated with this approach would be people like the world of Munkach, right, and Satmar. These are the Hasidic sects that we more often associate with anti-Zionism. And Lubavitchers I certainly would not say they're not anti-Zionist, right? But this idea, right, of the Geula, of the modern state of Israel being part of a redemptive process, is something which the Lubavitcher Rebbe was quite clear in opposing. And of course, it's interesting, right, because the Lubavitch world itself, it has a whole, right, complicated relationship with redemption and Mashiach, right? But here it's quite clear in the middle of page 2. It says, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, the period in which we are now living is not the beginning of the redemption. And the Aliyah of many Jews to the Holy Land is not the ingathering of exiles, but rather the possibility of rescuing many Jews during the time of exile. The false redemption does not allow the true redemption to be revealed, for those who think that they are already living in the redemption do not perform the religious actions required for the going forth from exile and the revealing of the true redemption. They cause the prolongation of the exile of the individual, the exile of the community, the exile of all of Israel, and the exile of the Shekhinah. So here you have the Lubavitcher Rebbe making an argument which is made over and over again, which argues that no, in fact, we don't see the promises of the redemption being fulfilled in the state of Israel today. Particularly, why? What is it missing? What does he say?
Observance,
right? Because if you look at the psukim, the verses that describe a coming back to the land, they're often associated also with a coming back to God, which is understood to mean halachic practice of the way in which God had intended. If they're not doing that, then this is not right. This is not the redemption. Not only are they not doing it, but what's happening?
They're prolonging.
Why?
I'm struggling to understand why he thinks, and maybe it's just semantics, but it says that it doesn't allow the true redemption to be revealed. People who are not performing those religious actions, are they, so is he referring to the Chiloni population that is building this country
right
at this time? But they're not building it out of a sense of redemption either. They're not thinking about the Ulah, they're thinking statehood, they're thinking,
right.
So it's just funny that he's, you know, that's not their intent, but he's saying as if, like, you think you're living, but that's not what they're thinking. I would say that the people who thought it was the Ulah were doing the actions required
But why does he think that the secular Israel, that this notion of secular Jews in Israel is prolonging the redemption? Why?
Because they already think that they are being redeemed, so why would they change their path?
Except that the secular Jews, like Alicia was saying, aren't really even thinking about redemption at all. He does say that, right? He says, like, they think they're living, right, and therefore don't have to perform these religious actions. But I think it's a little, I think it's a little deeper than that, and it's something that we.
It's obvious because to create another Switzerland out of Israel is not a redemptive process.
Okay.
We're not Swiss, and we're not ever become.
Okay.
And that's the prevailing notion of secular Israelis. If you talk to them, why can't we be just like Switzerland?
Okay.
I have all the ingredients.
Right.
But the one ingredient is missing is the, you know.
Okay.
Swiss neshama, which doesn't.
I don't know if I'm answering your question, but it's interesting that he's conceding that Israel is saving lives.
Yep.
But he's implying that they shouldn't.
I don't think that's the case.
He says that there's the possibility of rescuing many Jews during the time of exile, but since that's prolonging the exile of the Shekhinah, that of course we want Mashiach and the redemption to come. So he's conceding that it is saving Jewish lives, but that he's implying it's a bad thing.
Getting Shekhinah away from it.
I read it more like that's, if they're doing anything, that's what they're doing, but that's about it. That's all this is accomplishing, is this possibility. So don't get excited. This is not the big.
No, but they're doing more than they're just accomplishing saving Jews. They're prolonging the exile.
Right. So I understand this idea of prolonging the exile as related to the notion of creating an alternative Jewish identity, a secular Jewish identity, right? Which again is something that we do see in Israel today, right? The notion that I can be a Jew, that by living in Israel, I am a Jew, right? And I'm much more of a Jew than a secular American Jew. Right, because I have a sense of identity as a Jew. I live in the Jewish state. I fight for the Jewish state. Right, and I think what he's saying is that being able to live and exist, we never had that before. Right, where you could live and identify as a Jew and feel Jewish and feel like you're doing Jewish. Right, but it be unrelated to what he considers the true redemptive process, and that is sort of religious practice. And so I think he may be suggesting that's why it's prolonging, because it's giving them an alternative identity, right, unrelated to the one that ultimately he thinks is going to bring, right, that ge'ula.
Maybe even more so, because you could say that, I don't know if he believed this, that the essence of, some people say that the essence of keeping the mitzvah, or the place to keep the mitzvah, is Israel, and if you're doing the opposite, then you may be prolonging it in that sense.
So there are definitely those, right, who will make that argument as well. On the bottom of the page, Rav Shach represents a very different element in the community. Rav Shach was the great leader of the Lithuanian Jewish community in Israel. He lived in Israel. So that's what we would associate more with the yeshiva community rather than the Hasidic community. And as you can see, he's quite adamant. The Jewish people are still in exile, right, until the arrival of the Redeemer, even when they are in Eretz Yisrael. This is neither redemption nor the beginning of redemption. And since it is still exile, therefore we're commanded not to defy the nations of the world. That's a reference to the most commonly made theological argument against, right, seeing Israel as a redemptive, part of the redemptive process. And it refers to a statement in the Gemara. It's a Gemara in Ketubot that talks about God having made three oaths. Two oaths that he made the Jewish people swear, and one that he himself swore. The two that he made the Jewish people swear is that they will not ascend the wall. They will not force the redemption. Number two, they will not rebel against the nations of the world. And then God swears that he will not allow the oppression of the nations of the world to get too bad. And so it's an agadic statement of the rabbis, which plays a very strong role in so much of this conversation. And on the one hand, those arguing that oath prevents us from doing anything that would bring the redemptive process. Others arguing that it's not supposed to be understood literally in that way. Others arguing still yet, right, that in fact God's piece of this bargain was broken with the Holocaust, right, and therefore, right, the part that we're held by doesn't hold up anymore either. But again, that's the theological argument, and one that I don't want to focus on today. I want to focus on the historical roots behind this. So that's generally seen, right, as the dynamic in the Orthodox Jewish world today. On the one hand, those in the Dati Leumi community arguing that indeed this is Reishit Tzmichat Gulatenu, this is the beginning of the redemptive process. Those, whether in the Hasidic world or in the Mitnagdic world, arguing that no, right, that this in fact is not a part of a redemptive process.
defying nations.
So that's a reference to that Gemara that says that we are obligated not to defy the nations of the world, right? That's what we're obligated not to ascend, right, the wall, not to bring on the redemptive process, and that we're supposed to, we're not supposed to go against the nations. So the nations of the world, right, don't want us don't want us heralding some sort of redemptive age today, then that's the way that it needs to be until God says otherwise.
UN.
But the UN
vote. Right, except that the UN did ultimately vote, right, for the state of Israel, which makes it a little complicated. Okay, so I think that from a historical perspective, it's generally assumed that the voices that we have in our community today actually mimic quite closely the voices that we heard at the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century. And so if we take a look back, we actually find some striking resemblance, right, between what we're hearing today, right, and what was argued already well before, right, the state of Israel existed, just as the Zionist movement was first coming into its own all the way back in the 1860s and then through to the 1890s and the creation of the World Zionist Movement. So let's look at those voices, and then we'll talk about whether in fact they do reflect and accurately reflect what we hear in our contemporary community. So on the one hand, if we're tracing back the roots of the more messianic elements of the Zionist movement, right, the notions that a state of Israel today, it can reflect part of a redemptive process, so that line is almost always drawn back to two people in the middle of the 19th century, Rav Yehuda Alkalai and Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer. Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer, rabbi in Prussia, in the middle of the 19th century, writes an influential book called Drishat Zion, right? And you have a passage from it on the top of page 3. Let's read it together. He writes, "The redemption of Israel, for which we long, is not to be imagined as a sudden miracle. The Almighty, blessed be his name, will not suddenly descend from on high and command his people to go forth. He will not send the Messiah from heaven in a twinkling of an eye, to the sound of a great trumpet for the scattered of Israel, and gather them into Jerusalem. He will not surround the holy city with a wall of fire or cause the holy temple to descend from the heavens. The bliss and the miracles that were promised by his servants, the prophets, will certainly come to pass. Everything will be fulfilled, but we will not run in terror and flight, for the redemption of Israel will come by slow degrees, and the ray of deliverance will shine forth gradually. My dear reader, cast aside the conventional view that the Messiah will suddenly sound a blast on a great trumpet and cause all the inhabitants of the earth to tremble. On the contrary, the redemption will begin by awakening support among the philanthropists and by gaining the consent of the nations to the gathering of some of the scattered of Israel into the Holy Land. So Rabbi Kalischer begins by articulating a vision of how the redemptive process is going to work in stages. And he distinguishes between what has traditionally been called Mashiach ben Yosef and Mashiach ben David. The stage of Mashiach ben Yosef is one that comes naturally, one that people bring through a political process, and that ultimately paves the way for Mashiach ben David, which is much more of a supernatural process. Perhaps most famously, Zvi Hirsch Kalischer, as part of this process, makes what halachic argument that what else should be done now in the 1860s? Not only should we go back to Israel, but, anybody know? Not quite. But before building the Beit HaMikdash, he believes that they can start bringing karbonot. Right, so the sacrificial process, he believes, can start again, right? Even without the Beit HaMikdash back. And he believes it's something that Jews can do and should do, already starting in the 19th century. Okay. By the time we get to the end of the 19th century, though, there are clearly those who are quite adamant in their objection to these ideas. So, sticking with the theme that we started with, we're going to stick in the Lubavitch world. Again, it's representative, and I think it's a far more moderate strain, right, than what we find coming out of some of the other circles, Hasidic circles. But Shalom Dov Ber Schneerson, I think he was the fifth of the Lubavitch. Did I get that right? Mm-hmm. Yeah? Okay. Came out very strongly against this idea as well. So even if these men were loyal to God and his Torah, and even if there were a chance that they would achieve their goal, we must not listen to them in this matter to make our redemption with our own power. Is it not forbidden to even to force the end with excessive prayer? All the more so that with power and worldly methods, that is, to leave exile by force, we are not permitted. And this is against our true hope that God will bring us the Messiah soon and our redemption will come through God himself. It's the exact same line of argument. Over 100 years ago, the same thing being said, we cannot force the end, we cannot bring about redemption on our own, and even regardless of whether these people are observant, not observant, it's not something we can do. Sefer Das HaRabbanim was an interesting volume that was put out, that it was a collection of major rabbinic personalities from across Europe, published in 1902, expresses the very same thing, rabbis from across Central and Eastern Europe, that's important. It never occurred to our brethren, the children of Israel, upholders of the Torah and commandments, that there could be the redemption other than by the will of the Holy One, blessed be he, to redeem us. And we are full of hope that, at the time of his choosing to redeem us, he shall send us Eliyahu HaNavi with the righteous Mashiach ben David. Only this we are obliged to do, preserve and observe all the commandments of God, which are more pleasant than gold and sweeter than honey. Stop with this idea of trying to bring a redemptive process and observe, preserve, do what we're doing, right, and don't try to change it. In the top of page 4, Rav Yosef Ber Soloveitchik, one of the great leaders of the Lithuanian Jewish community, the non-Hasidic community, in the late 19th century, is quoted as having said, right, that the Chovevei Tzion, the lovers of Zion, are a new sect like that of Shabtai Tzvi, may the name of the evil ones rot. Now, that brings us more into the historical element of what's happening here. Right? And that is, any time Jews enter into a talk of the Messiah and redemption, there are echoes, right, and tremors that are felt in the Jewish community, particularly in the European Jewish community, right, of times long ago when there were false cries of redemption, where persecution led people to such a state of despair that when somebody came along and said, "I'm the Messiah," and the Messianic age has come, people were so desperate, right, to believe it, and wanted to believe it, needed to believe it, that they hitched, right, their wagon with these people. It's Shabtai Tzvi, the most famous of them, but there were others. Jacob Frank, right, is another, and it ultimately led to a crushing blow when it became clear that these were not, in fact, messiahs, that this, in fact, was not redemptive age. And so Yosef Beer Soloveitchik, the original Brisker Rav, it says, stay away from this. Right, it's going to lead you to disappointment, disillusionment. Again, this is Shabtai Tzvi. Again, right? We must stay away. So again, on the face of things, it might seem, right, that the world of 19th century really pretty much parallels the world that we have today. On the one hand, we have this this emergence of a religious Zionist movement that does see the possibility for the bringing of redemption and returning to the land of Israel, and then you have by far the louder voices emanating both from the Hasidic world and from the Mitnagdic world that say, no, stay away, we cannot do that, this is not and will not be part of a redemptive process. I think what often gets lost in the shuffle is that, in fact, the majority of the religious Zionist camp in the 19th century, into the 20th century, actually explicitly distanced themselves from any element of messianism. and so what you have at the bottom of page 4 is a letter written by Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, the Netziv, who was he wrote it in, as you can see on the top, Tafshin Tafresh Nun Aleph, so that's 1891, so this is very much at the end of his life, at which point he was widely revered as he was the Rosh Yeshiva, the head of the largest yeshiva in the world at the time, and one of the leaders of European Jewry as a whole. But what's fascinating about the Netziv is that he was also known as a very strong supporter of the Zionist movement. And in this, he broke with the establishment of the Eastern European rabbinic leadership, almost all of whom, very much opposed the Zionist movement because it was a secular movement, right? And they were afraid of the consequences of that. The Netziv came out, clearly wrote several letters in support of the Zionist movement, has letters going back and forth with Leon Pinsker, right, about his involvement in the Zionist movement. He was actually the honorary chairman of Chibat Zion in Vilna, and unabashed in his support. And so it wasn't surprising that when a new printing of Drishat Zion, of Kalischer's book, right, had come out, people came to him and said, can we get your, what's called a haskama, can we get your approbation on this text, right? Because it's going to sell, right, even better if they have a letter from the Netziv in the beginning saying, buy this book, right, it represents our ideology, right, it's going to sell far more than just being a book by Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer. And so they came to him, and they said, will you please write a you who has established himself as a leader of the religious Zionist, right, the beginnings of a religious Zionist movement, one of the few great gedolim, right, of European Jewry who have come out and said that he supports this return to the land of Israel, the early settlement of the land of Israel, will you write a letter in support of this book? And his answer is no. An interesting side note, if you look at the top of the, so we're on page 4, if you look at the heading, this just tells you how much an editor can do, right, when putting a book together. The editor gave a title to this letter that the Netziv never gave to it, right? To emphasize what the editor wanted you to take away from this letter, right? So the title says Shalom Lirot Be'Esek HaYishuv Simanei HaGeula, right? That you shall not see in what's happening in Israel any signs of redemption. Now he does say that, but it's clear that that's what the editor wanted you to take away. So here's what he says. I apologize. This is the one text that I don't know that it exists in English, and I didn't have the time to translate it. So it says as follows. You have the address, you have the date on top, so this is in the seventh month, right? It's actually, it's actually Tzom Gedalia, exactly, right? It's actually 1890, right? It just switched to Tafshin Reish Nun Aleph, so it's 1890, so. So Kvod HaRav Muflag V'Darshan, he's giving, this is an honorary address to some rabbinic author who wrote to him, asking him to write this approbation. So he writes as follows. Kvar katavti b'ktzara l'malat kvodo nero ya'ir she'ein nafshi nocha me'asefer drishat tzion she'ela HaRav HaGaon, and then he leaves out his name. Right, he says, I've already written to you, right, with all due respect, I don't like this book, Drishat Tzion. Kinosad al or mitael shera'a be'artzot ha'ma'arav shenitan shivui zechuyot la'achinu v'yamidameh ki zehu havtachat v'shav Hashem elokecha et shvutcha v'richamecha me'ata aleinu lahagia l'sofeh adikra v'shav v'kibetzcha v'gomer u'b'mechilat kvodo einan ela dvarim b'teilim. He said this book is founded on faulty assumptions. It's founded on the notion that the emancipation that is happening in Western Europe today, right, the giving of zechuyot, of rights, to our brethren in Western Europe, and he's writing from Eastern Europe, right, is part of this process, is the promise that God is going to bring you back to the land of Israel, right, and that's what's ultimately going to lead to the ingathering of exiles. And he says, with all due respect, these are dvarim b'teilim. This is nonsense. It's not right. And he gives you three reasons for why it's not right. Number one, she'ikar shvut Yisrael eino be'arto tam ha'arav ki'im bi'ar k'tei tzafon. V'yirmiyahu ha'navi amar she'mitchila hineni mevi otam me'eretz tzafon. V'achar kach v'kibatztim bi'ar k'tei aretz. He says, first of all, and news for you, right? Most Jews aren't living in Western Europe. He's right. Right? The vast majority of Jews at the time are living in Eastern Europe. He calls it the Tzafon, in the north, right? So, to some, depending on where, it is certainly north, right, of Israel. And he said not only that, but our prophecy is actually right, that the beginnings of the redemption are going to come from the north, right? Not from the west, not from Prussia and Germany and France. So that's number one. Number two, Shezeha or Shel Shivuiz Chuyot, Hechshichene Achenu Be'erzot Amarav, Heisir Tzurat Ayadut, Zulat Yechidei Sgula. He says, and you know what? This thing you're calling, right, part of this emancipation, which you're celebrating, is ruining our people, right? Because they're abandoning Judaism. Right? As a result of this emancipation and being given of these rights, with the exception of a few special people. And number three, Shari lifneze amikra k'tiv v'shavta ad Hashem elokecha v'shamata b'kalo v'lo hechili kayim klal. And number three, he said, you're focusing on the verses that say, and God will redeem you, right, and bring you back, right, from the corners of the earth. Well, he said, there's a pasuk before that. The verse before that says, the people will return to God, and then God will return them to Israel. And that hasn't happened at all, he said. And then he writes, Od zot sheyisod dat hageon hanal shezehu tchilat hageula ubezeh mistayim dvarav levaer heich nagia lidei hageula ubeemet ein adam yodea ad ma seder hageula ha'atida. He says, and at the end of the day, right, his whole project here is about the redemptive process. It's identifying this as the beginning of the promised redemption. And he said, we do not know, we cannot know, right, whether this is or this isn't, and therefore he cannot give his approbation to this book. The Nitziv, though, is just the beginning, right, of this type of approach. On top of page 5, you have a paragraph from Rav Yaakov Reines, a letter that he wrote. Now, Rav Yaakov Reines is a little bit younger than the Tziv, probably famous in his day, famous for a yeshiva that he started in the city of Lida that actually incorporated general studies, secular studies, into their learning. Probably the first Eastern European yeshiva to do so. But he's best known as the founder of Mizrahi. Now, Mizrahi, let's talk about that for a minute. Mizrahi is an acronym. Does everybody know that? Probably most people don't, right? What does Mizrahi stand for? Amazing. I guess we're thrown off because it means something, right? Mizrahi means, right, has to do with east, right? Now, of course, these are people which the Nesiv just reminded us, right, are living Biar Ketei Tzafon, right? So it's they're actually, right, not so interested in the east. Mizrahi stands for Merkaz Ruchani, meaning the religious, the spiritual center. Mizrahi was started as an internal division of the World Zionist movement by the Orthodox constituents to that movement who felt like, who were worried, right, that there was an educational program that was developing in the World Zionist movement to educate the youth around ideas of resettlement of the land of Israel. But that educational program was divorced from or devoid of any type of religious element, and therefore they started a unit within the World Zionist movement, the World Zionist Congress, a center for spiritual infusion into the World Zionist movement. That's what Mizrahi was initially. I think it was founded first in 1897 as part of the movement, and then it actually broke away in 1902 by people like Shmuel Mohilever and others who felt like it could no longer exist within the movement, needed to be something outside of the movement on its own, and that was the beginnings of the Mizrahi that we have today. But Rav Yaakov Reines, he is the epitome of religious Zionism in the late 19th century, early 20th century. He writes as follows: anyone who thinks the Zionist idea is somehow associated with a future redemption and the coming of the Messiah, and who therefore regards it as undermining our holy faith, is clearly in error. Zionism has nothing whatsoever to do with the question of redemption. The entire point of this idea is merely the improvement of the condition of our wretched brethren. In recent years, our situation has deteriorated disastrously, and many of our brethren are scattered in every direction to the seven seas and places where the fear of assimilation is hardly remote. The Zionists saw that the only fitting place for our brethren to settle would be the Holy Land. And if some preachers, while speaking of Zion, also mention redemption and the coming of the Messiah, and thus let the abominable thought enter people's minds that this idea encroaches upon the territory of true redemption, only they themselves are to blame, for it is their own wrong opinion they express. That's a strong distancing from this idea and the connection between the return to the land, the settlement of the land of Israel, and the redemptive process. The manifesto which Mizrahi themselves put out in 1902 is not nearly as strong in its distancing, and in fact does have a little bit of redemptive language in it, but nonetheless it's also clear that the platform, the basics of what Mizrahi was intended to do was not to hasten the redemption, to bring the Messiah. That's really not where their primary focus was. So on the bottom of page 5, in the lands of the diaspora, the soul of our people, our holy Torah, can no longer be preserved in its full strength, nor can the commandments which comprise the entire spiritual life of the people be kept in their original purity, because the times are besieging us with difficult demands. What's the relationship between this and what Rabbi Reines wrote? What's the common theme?
Diaspora, it's getting real bad.
That's right. Right, it's getting really hard to be a religious Jew, right, in the diaspora.
Right.
It's not due to oppression, largely, but rather due to assimilation.
Right.
It is impossible for us to respond to these demands without ignoring the holy treasure entrusted to us at Sinai, without, God forbid, turning it into a thing of little value in our eyes, as each of us strays further and further away from the other. Against his will, each loses his Jewish self in the non-Jewish majority, for only in their midst can he fulfill all those secular requirements which the times demand of him. The people has found one remedy for this affliction: to direct their hearts to that one place which has always been the focus of our prayers, that place wherein the oppressed of our people will find their longed-for respite, Zion and Jerusalem. We have always been united by that ancient hope, by the promise which lies at the very roots of our religion, namely that only out of Zion will the Lord bring redemption, that's the one reference, to the people of Israel. The emancipation which our German brethren so desired did much to divide us and keep us scattered in the countries of our dispersion. When the limbs are dispersed, the body disintegrates, and when there is no body, the spirit has no place to dwell in this world. It has therefore been agreed by all those who love the spirit of their people and are faithful to God's Torah that the reawakening of the hope of the return to Zion will provide a solid foundation as well as lend a special quality to our people. It will serve as a focus for the ingathering of our spiritual forces and as a secure fortress of our Torah and its sanctuary. Right? again, even though there is a slight, there is one mention of redemption, this is clearly not, right, the focus. This is not an attempt, like Kalischer had been writing, right, to bring back and to herald, right, the redemptive process. So what I want to do with you now is two things. First of all, I want to take even the 19th century approach to the redemptive process, the messianic element of Zionism, place that into an important context, and then I want to move us forward back again and say, if in fact this was not a strong piece of the original thinking of religious Zionism, what has happened since, and how do we understand where we are today? I think that to understand, although this is not mine. Yosef Salmon is one of the great historians of Zionism, and he had, I think, an incredibly important insight into understanding Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer and the beginnings of this messianic element in religious Zionism that cannot be ignored. In order to understand it, though, we have to take one step even further back. We said that Drishat Zion came out in 1862. We need to turn the clocks back all the way to 1819. Anybody know what happened in 1819? Critical for the Jewish religious world? You want to say the Hep-Hep riots. You weren't going to say the Hep-Hep riots. 1819. Critical moment in the development of modern Judaism. Something known as the Hamburg Temple Controversy. The Hamburg Temple controversy is the first official moment of schism, right, in the religious world between what will become a reform movement and what will become an Orthodox movement, right, in response thereto. For several years up until before 1819, there had been some movement in some of the synagogues in Germany in particular, Prussia in particular, to introduce certain aesthetic reforms to the synagogue service. So particularly, they were looking at the way in which their synagogues looked. They were looking at how the service went and the aesthetic beauty associated with it. And it was in Hamburg for the first time that certain changes were proposed. Now, let's take for a moment, though, and just orient ourselves. 1819. The Jews in Western Europe in 1819 are living in a different world. Right? The young generation, the millennials, right, of the 19th century, right, have been grown up in a world vastly different than their parents and grandparents. Why? What's different about the world in 1819? Okay, so we're almost there, right? In fact, what happened to many Jews is that they tasted emancipation, right? When Napoleon goes on his conquest, right, through Europe, he emancipates all Jews, right? That in any of the territories that he conquers. And then what happens to Napoleon?
Exile.
And when was that? Right.
1815.
Right, 1850. So in the first decades of the 19th century, you have a community that is, you have these young people who are post-Enlightenment, right? They're post-French Revolution. French Revolution, right, the French wanted to start counting, right, years again from zero, right, after the French Revolution. It was that momentous of a time, right? So the world has changed. A post-French Enlightenment world is a totally different world. It's a modern world. It's an enlightened world. And then comes Napoleon, marches through Europe, and it says to the Jews and everybody else, we're all citizens, right, of this great country. All you need to do is be a citizen, and now you have rights that Jews never in a million years imagined, right? And then comes 1815 and it all gets rolled back, right, in most places. So they've tasted it, right, and now many of them have lost it. And it begins to, and so a number of things begin to come together, right, for the Jews of Western Europe. On the one hand, they are different, and their Judaism needs to reflect who they are. And they're not connecting in the same ways. So this small shtiebel, right, and the rabbi with the long beard from Eastern Europe who came over to serve in this particular town in Western, that's not going to do it for them anymore, right? Because they're living in a much more modern world than an enlightened world. Right? They look around and they look at religion in their world, and religion, the dominant religion, is what? But Protestant Christianity in most of the places that they are living, right, which is considered the enlightened religion of the time. Right? They look at the aesthetics of what's happening in those houses of worship and compares it, you know, to what's happening in their little synagogues, and it doesn't speak to them. So they're looking for ways, right, to bring and to connect in a way, right, that they were a bit unable to do in their traditional service. And the other thing that they're trying to do is that there's a deep sense that if we are going to be fully emancipated, if we're going to get those rights back, what we need to show people and the rest of our community is that we are citizens. We're citizens like anybody else. We can be contributing citizens to our larger society. And then that will convince them to give us back, right, those rights and to treat us fully like everybody else. And so in Hamburg, what happens as follows is one of the synagogue, there's a new organization that has started in order to create a synagogue. These things in Hamburg at the time are under the control of the government, right? So you needed to get official permission to do these kinds of things. They wanted to start a synagogue. In the synagogue, the proposal was that there were going to be three significant changes to the way in which synagogues had been, service had been done previously. Number one, there was going to be an organ in the synagogue. And the organ was going to be played by a non-Jew. Right? So there was no suggestion that any Jew was going to break Shabbos, but somebody else was going to do, but it was going to create an atmosphere. Right? That's number one. Number two, they were going to introduce prayers in German. Right? And number three, and the one that gets the least attention, is that they were going to cut out certain references to a return to Zion. Now, why were they going to do that?
You're not a good citizen,
right,
if you want to leave.
Right.
How are we going to convince people to give us our rights, right, as Prussians if three times a day we're standing up and saying, God, take us back to Israel? Mm-hmm. That's not going to work out very well for us. Right? And so in order to do this, they needed to get the approval, official approval of the government. In order to get the official approval of the government, they had to go through the Beit Din in Hamburg. In order to do that, they needed a rabbinic opinion to say that these things were, in fact, allowed by Jewish law. And on the top of page 6, you have one such rabbinic opinion in a work called Or Noga. You see the year is 1818. And this is what the founders of the synagogue went out to try and solicit these opinions. And you can see that he writes quite clearly, right, that he's talking about these ideas of redemption in the text. He writes that what is merely here, is what it's referred to here is not actual redemption, but merely our deliverance from the troubles of exile. Right? And in the second paragraph, he writes, "To be sure, my brethren and compatriots, tears well up in the eyes of every man of feeling when he remembers that our holy city is burnt and its gates desolate. And we must say along with the exiles, if I forget thee, O Jerusalem, nevertheless, the prayer for the land of our birth, our present dwelling place, must take precedence in time, and we should always pray for its safety and for the well-being of its people." The Hamburg Beit Din did not take kindly, right, to what was happening. They realized that they themselves didn't quite have the clout to oppose it, and so they sent a letter soliciting halachic opinions from the great halachic authorities of Western and Central and the Habsburg Empire, right, at the time, the Austro-Hungarian Empire at the time. Right, those tshuvot, those responses were collected into a work called Eile Divrei Habrit. These are the words of the covenant. The focus of this of these tshuvot were these three elements, the elements of the organ in the synagogue, the changing of words in, of the sayings tefillot in German, and taking out references to a return to Zion. So you can see in the bottom right-hand corner of page 6, let's look at the brackets. Worst of all, they have perpetrated a sore evil by removing all references to the belief in the ingathering of the exiles. Okay. If you flip the page 7, you can see that by the time the 1840s came, this became a staple of what was to become the reform movement. If you look at the paragraph on the bottom, there's a resolution adopted by the majority, right, that the messianic idea should receive prominent mention in the prayers, but all petitions for our return to the land of our fathers and for the restoration of the Jewish state should be eliminated from the liturgy. Right? This became a critical piece of the early reform movement. Okay. Page 8. The way in which historians have traditionally characterized the impact of the Hamburg Temple controversy in 1819 is that A, it gave rise to a reform movement, B, it also gave rise to two different Orthodox responses to this movement. On the one hand, you had the world of Central European Jewry, Hungarian Jewry in particular, led at first by a man by the name of Rabbi Moshe Sofer, the Chassam Sofer, but then really amplified by his son-in-law and then his students in the generation after. And that is what today is often known as ultra-Orthodoxy. It is a position defined around the slogan that the Chassam Sofer himself used, Chadash Asur Min HaTorah, and that any change is prohibited. Right? So in other words, these reformers were trying to change things which actually, in its initial form, probably one could make a legal argument to justify them. Comes along, this group of Orthodoxy says the times have changed, we can change nothing anymore. Right? We've got to dig in our heels because it's a slippery slope. You change one little thing, you're going to change something else, and ultimately the whole thing is going to be lost. That is the approach that was taken. And so if you look at the star, that's Hamburg. And so if you look down into the, if you look south and to the east, you see the city of Pressburg. That's where the Chassam Sofer had his yeshiva. Ultimately, his students will move eastward into the lands of the Carpathian Mountains, and that's where the beginnings of Hungarian Orthodoxy will arise. They will actually ally with many of the Hasidic groups from there, which includes places like Satmar and Munkacs, and they will ally around this idea that we change nothing. Right? We can't change nothing because ultimately that will lead to our demise. But there was another response. And so if you look at the circle that says Frankfurt, right, there was another response, which was the response traditionally called Neo-Orthodoxy, that is by the German Orthodox world, that said, you know what, no, not so fast. There are actually pieces of this that we can adopt. We need to be clear. Where do we draw those lines? Right, so around the world of Rav Hirsch, it emerges a different approach, which says, no, we can do some of these things. So, in fact, we're going to bring a choir into the synagogue. Had never been done before. Right? Rav Hirsch wrote war canonicals, right? The dress of a Protestant clergyman. He gave his sermon in German. It introduced many of the aesthetic things that were halachically permissible in order to reach those same Jews, right, who were potentially being reached by the Reform movement, to keep them away. He said, no, there are certain things we can change, we ought to change, right, but yet clearly drawing the line between what is halachically permissible and what is not. So Neo-Orthodoxy and Ultra-Orthodoxy. Here's what Salmon points out. You see, Rav Hirsch grew up actually in Hamburg, right, at the turn of the 19th century. His world as a young man was this world of the Hamburg Temple controversy. His father was was a prominent person. He grew up, that was the Shabbos table conversation. Right? It was what was happening with these new reformers. The Chassam Sofer, same thing. Right? He's actually a little bit older, right? But he was actually one of the respondents to the Hamburg Temple controversy. He was just beginning his career, right, as a rabbinic authority at the time, but very much shaped by what happened there. And so Salmon argues that you need to see Zvi Hirsch Kalischer in exactly the same way. Right? Zvi Hirsch Kalischer, look at his dates, 1795 to 1874. In 1819, he's a young, right, passionate, idealistic, a budding Torah scholar, seeing, and he's living in Western Europe. That's Prussia. That's still very much Western Europe. So he's hearing, seeing what's happening here. And remember, there were three major changes that were being suggested. One was the introduction of an organ. The second was davening in German. But the third one was
removing
any reference to a return to Zion. And so says Zvi Hirsch Kalischer, no, you know what? You know how we're going to respond to this? We're going to return to Zion. Let's do it. Right? Forget about talking about it. Forget about praying about it. The time has come. Look, we now have rights by the time it gets to the 1860s. We have the opportunities. There are philanthropists who will support us. There are governments who will support us. The best way to respond to this emerging reform movement, to this fear that people have that Judaism is going to get lost, right, in Eastern Europe, in Western Europe, is to actually go. Get up and go. That's the response. Right? And that's clearly, right, where it comes from. It's the very same role that produced Rav Hirsch, produced Chassam Sofer, produces another response which says we need to go back, right? And not only go back, but let's start doing those things. The very things they cut out of their service, karbanos, right? References to sacrifices, we can do them. In fact, let's go and let's start doing them, and let's start doing them right now. So even in the world of the 19th century then, right, the connection between a redemptive process and ingathering of exiles, right, and Zionism has to be seen in a very particular historical moment. The question then becomes, and I know we're getting late, so the question becomes, so what's changed? Right? Why is it today that the predominant voices of religious Zionism do affiliate with a more messianic view, whereas it seems in the 19th century and the early 20th century, they clearly did not. And so what I would say and suggest is history has changed. Right? Things happened. Very important things happened between the turn of the 20th century and the world that we live in today. And those historical events, more than anything, are what shaped a sense that even if they were unsure back then, today we are sure, right, that this is in fact a redemptive process. And that begins with Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Kook. Rav Kook, who by the way was a student of the Netziv, right, and the Netziv who said, you cannot see, right, any signs of the Geula in what's happening today. So Rav Kook was shaken most significantly by what major event? No, Rav Kook didn't live through the Holocaust. Right? Huh? World War I. Right, Rav Kook actually gets caught in England, I think. Right, during England or France? England, I think, during World War I, is unable to return. He had come to raise funds. He could not return to the land of Israel because the war broke out. Right? But for those of us, right, who aren't history buffs, right, World War I mean, it was the greatest calamity, right, that humanity had ever seen. Right? There had been it was the First World War. There had never been anything quite like it. It wreaked destruction and death in ways that people had... the globe had never seen before. And so Rav Kook looks at this and says, there's something happening here that is unlike anything else that has ever happened in history. And so if you look at the top of page 9, right, the voice of God calls out mightily. His call is attested in the recesses of our soul and by the changing process of life. Israel must tap the source of its life and plant itself on the feet of its spiritual character. Look at the next sentence. World civilization is crumbling. The human spirit is weakened and darkness is enveloping all the nations. And this is a dark, dark time unlike any other that humanity has ever witnessed. It must mean something, says Rav Kook. And therefore, he writes, the time is ripe. This must be the moment, right, in which something is supposed to happen. That's Rav Kook. Rav Kook never lives to see the creation of the State of Israel. Right? But he believes that by looking around at what is happening in the world, it suggests that in fact they are and have entered a different time. By all means, please go. thanks for coming. That's Rav Kook. That's Rav Avraham Yitzchak Cohen Kook. His son, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook, now lives through several more really momentous historical events, starting with World War II. Right, and the Holocaust, followed by the creation of the State of Israel, followed by victories in Sinai, followed by victories in 1967, followed by a difficult victory, ultimately in the Yom Kippur War, and now things, if it wasn't clear before, how could it not be clear now? That something is clearly happening in the historical process. It says Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook, at the bottom of page 9, the Jewish people has been brought here severed from the depths of exile to come to the State of Israel. The blood of the 6 million represents a substantial excision, right, from the body of the nation. Our whole people has undergone heavenly surgery at the hands of the destroyers. May their names be blotted out. God's people had clung so determinately to the impurity of foreign lands that when the end time arrived, they had to be cut away with a great shedding of blood. Rather controversial, right? This cruel excision reveals our real life, the rebirth of the nation, the land, the rebirth of the Torah, and all that is holy. These historical, cosmological, divine facts must be seen as such. Seeing is more than understanding. It is encounter with the master of the universe. Right? So if we take ourselves back to where we started, to the statement of Rav Shlomo Aviner, right? You can't not but see God in the Golan, right? And see him through the sweeping through the Sinai, and see him the events of the recapture of the old city. It can't be anything else. And so, from what was a distancing of the notion of redemption in the late 19th century, comes the sense that history is just calling out to us in a way that it never has before. And so, it must be that this is indeed Reshit Tzmichat Geulatim. So I want to leave you, though, with a slightly different voice, right? A voice that I think is calling back today to similar voices actually back at the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century. But help us at least to contextualize where we are today, perhaps, for a richer understanding of where we are today. And that's the voice of a teacher of mine, a teacher of David's, Rav Yehuda Amital. Rav Yehuda Amital, for those who don't know, was a survivor of the Holocaust, who comes to Israel. He is one of the architects of the Hesder movement, founds the yeshiva in Alon Shvut, known today as Gush. He is a student of Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook, considers himself as having learned quite a bit, right, from that world. And early on in his career, it was actually his texts that were pointed to, right, for exactly this type of redemptive quality. So if you look at the top of page 10, he wrote, right, "We are commanded to live with the faith that, since the beginning of the modern return to Zion, there is no going backwards. There may be temporary concealments, but no going backwards. All roads, paved or unpaved, lead to the redemption of Israel. This is part of the redemptive process," said Rav Yehuda Amital quite clearly on many occasions earlier in his career. That was 1974 that he wrote that. Fast forward to 1994, and Rav Yehuda Amital gives the following address to the students in Yeshivat Har Etzion. "Gentlemen, it may be that all those who spoke about the beginning of the flowering of our redemption were mistaken. It is possible that the students of the Vilna Gaon were mistaken. It may be that the students of the Baal Shem Tov were mistaken. Perhaps the students of Rabbi Akiva Eger were mistaken when they spoke about the beginnings of the flowering of our redemption, as described in their books. It may be that Rabbi Kook was mistaken. It may be that Rabbi Charlap was mistaken. Rabbi Akiva, the greatest of the Tanaim, was also mistaken." What's that a reference to?
Bar Kokhba.
Exactly. Rabbi Akiva said that Bar Kokhba was the Mashiach. He was wrong. And so says Rav Yehuda Amital, seeing something, now having distanced himself a little bit from 1967, from the Yom Kippur War, now importantly for him, having lost so many students along the way, having seen the pain and the suffering, having seen where the modern state was in terms of its moral character at times, and it says, you know what, mate, I'm less sure than I was, right, earlier on in my career. I think it's important to note that Avital never lost faith that what we see in the land of Israel is the hand of God, is the clear hand of God, and that it's often the miraculous hand of God, a hand of God that requires us to come together on Yom HaTzmud and say Hallel, the Shevach, and Hodayah HaKadosh Baruch Hu for doing things that have never been seen before in the history of mankind. That he never ever lost. Right? But the question of how closely it's linked, or with what degree of certainty can we say this is Reshit Tzmichat Geulatenu, that seems to be something that he had more questions about later in his life than he did earlier on. A few weeks ago, I asked Rav Moshe Lichtenstein, "So tell me, so what did Rav Amital think when he said Reshit Tzmichat Geulatenu? How did he, by the end, towards the end of his life? So how did he You know, how did he come to terms with it? And he said to me as follows. He said he thinks, number one, he doesn't even think Rav Amital ever lost the idea that the modern state of Israel is it's the base of the building. It's the foundation that's being built. Right? How many floors this building has, he doesn't know. And how long it's going to take to build each of the floors, said, that I'm not sure of anymore either. Right? But that it is a base, he says he doesn't think that he ever wavered on. And he said the other thing is that the language of Reshit Smichat, by the way, he said is a totally non-committal language. It's actually a double precursor. It's not just the beginnings of the redemption, it's the beginning of the flowering of redemption. And he said to him that was not something that he ever had trouble with, right? That much he could feel comfortable saying. So I wanted to leave you with this last source, which is also from late in the life of Rav Amital, where it does seem that he is clearly still talking about our redemptive process, but he shifts the focus to a place that I think is really important and for me very inspiring in terms of what does it mean to be part of a redemptive process? What is it going to take from us beyond moving to Israel, which we all need to do? Right? There is more that we need to do if, in fact, this is going to become part of that redemptive process. We have work to do, and it's important that he is not saying we need to force other people to do things. He's saying there are things we need to do in the land of Israel today to bring this about. And he writes as follows. Unlike the Haredim, we will not undermine the importance or legitimacy of the state, but our love for our country must not blind us from criticizing its shortcomings. We remain very, very far from the ideal Jewish state, and we must therefore do whatever we can to bring about its realization. A more just society and stronger communal values are necessary prerequisites for its actualization. If we want to hasten the ultimate redemption, we must work harder to ensure moral values on both the individual and communal levels. Closing the social gaps, concern for the vulnerable elements of society, fighting poverty, respectful treatment of the non-Jews in Israel, all these measures will bring us closer to the day for which we long. Says Rav Amital, those same visions of redemption, right, talk about a world of tzedek u'mishpat, talk about a world where we're looking out, right, for those who don't have, for those who are less fortunate in our society. And so he says, listen, today we can continue to see this in the framework of a redemptive process, even if we don't know how quickly it's going to happen, even if we don't know ultimately where it ends, but we need to start pointing the fingers back at ourselves and say, okay, if this is going to be that, how do we create the kind of society, right, that ultimately HaKadosh Baruch Hu had envisioned for us? So ultimately that brings us back to the present, to its tefillah, which I think perhaps now we see a broader range, right, and appreciate that there's quite a number of positions out there, that religious Zionism need not be a staunchly messianic position of any sort. Right? In fact, it didn't really start that way. There were events through the 20th century that absolutely spoke of a time that was unlike any other in the history of mankind. Right? But there are also those today, right, who can continue to say, I may not be as sure. I may not even be as sure as I once was, but I know what we need to do. I know that if we want this to be that, I know that we can say this is the beginnings in the sense that we have work to do to make sure that this state that we all love, this state that is part of our visions of our future, is ultimately going to be one that we can proudly say will be Reshit Tzmichat Geulateinu. Back to that.